Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm the culture editor at The Bulwark. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Scott Eyman, who is the author of 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck, and the creation of the modern film studio. And I'm especially pleased to have Mr. Eyman on because I'm a big fan of his John Wayne biography. It's exceptionally good if you're looking for something. If you're looking for a biography about a movie star to read, it gives you a good sense not only of Mr. Wayne, but the times in which he lived. Scott is an award-winning author of 16 books and about the movies, three of which have been New York Times bestsellers. And he's a frequent book reviewer for The Wall Street Journal, Film Comment, and The New York Observer. Thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Happy to be here, Sonny.
So let's talk about 20th Century Fox and Daryl F. Zanuck. But before we get to Daryl F. Zanuck, let's talk a little bit about William Fox, who was the founder of Fox Studios, which is one of the two studios that merged to form 20th Century Fox. Because what's really interesting about him is that he is not a traditional movie mogul in the sense that we think of these things. He was actually more of a real estate man, right?
He was a theater guy. That was his basic entry into show business. He opened a Nickelodeon. That was successful, so he opened another Nickelodeon and so on down the line. And then eventually he went into production because, as with anybody else who sits and watches a lot of movies, at some point the thought occurs to you, God, I could make movies that are better than this. You know? And it's this exact same thing that Louis B. Mayer did. He was a leading exhibitor in New England, and he decided to go into production for himself and was extremely successful and formed Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer a few years later. Fox did the same thing. He started his own production company in 1915, got lucky with Theda Bara, hit a nerve with a sexually aggressive female, which was something new in American culture, actually, not just American movies, but American culture. And I went on from there. But he was a New York guy. He would only come to L.A. Once a year under duress. Mm-hmm. He didn't like L.A. He wasn't comfortable there. He was essentially a real estate guy. And Adolf Zucker, who was one of the founders of Paramount Pictures, was also like that. Luckily, he had Jesse Lasky and Cecil B. DeMille working the West Coast because they were production guys and they weren't interested in New York, whereas Zucker was essentially a real estate guy, a theater guy, and he loved New York. So they were able to balance it off. But Fox stayed almost completely in New York and had to delegate the running of the actual Fox studio to various lieutenants, whom he essentially terrorized, playing Ebenezer Scrooge to several different people who were all terrified of being fired and losing their sinecure because Fox paid pretty well. And just to keep them guessing whenever, every once in a while, he'd give them an unasked for raise. Just to keep them totally unbalanced, you know, and then send them more insulting telegrams and night letters.
Yeah, it's interesting to read these opening chapters because he does sound like both a terror and also very confusing to work for this William Fox.
It would be chaotic. And because he was always wanting to spend less money. At the same time, he wanted the pictures to be better and better and better. He didn't really want to pay anybody anything. So you were being pulled in conflicting directions if you were actually trying to run production for William Fox, which meant in practice that you couldn't please him, which I suspect is what he wanted all along.
Yeah.
Anybody to feel they were pleasing him. He wanted to keep them uneasy and terrified.
Yeah. Well, the combination of being a major theater owner and a studio has its benefits, at least back then before the Paramount decrees, right? Because you could create movies that weren't necessarily great, but you could show them everywhere you wanted because you own the theaters.
They were vertically integrated corporations, which meant that you made money on both ends. You made money from the theater end. You made money on distribution because even if the film actually lost money in terms of what it grossed and its negative cost, distribution still took their 25% or 28%, whatever it happened to be, off the top. Mm-hmm. So you had all these different revenue streams coming in. Whereas after the Paramount decree, when the government said it was an antitrust thing and they had to divest themselves of the theaters, suddenly they lost two separate revenue streams. They lost theaters and they lost distribution. So they had to subsist solely on production. And at the same time, television lands with both feet. And all these guys like Zucker, like, well, Fox was dead by this time, but all these guys came out of theater. That was actually what was in their blood. They saw doing production as an evolutionary step, but mm-hmm. they understood real estate every bit as well as they understood production. So it was a body blow for them. And then TV lands at the same time, and suddenly they're hammered on both ends, you know, because yeah. the audience is simply leached away. Between 1946 and 1953, like 40% of the movie audience just disappears.
Yeah.
Starts staying, yeah. you know? And I mean, that's an extinction level event. That's what's happening with newspapers and magazines now. And it's an extinction level event. So, and they were all at this point in their 60s too. They were not feisty young guys full of piss and vinegar.
Yeah.
So they kind of, some of them were basically kicked upstairs. Zucker was kicked upstairs and basically was chairman emeritus. He actually didn't have any power anymore. Mayer got kicked out of MGM because the business cratered. And by that time, Zanuck had been ruling Fox since 1935.
Yeah.
So yeah, he wrote out the rough times because he was aggressive, and he came up with CinemaScope, which provided a effective, albeit temporary, a shot of adrenaline to the theater business.
Yeah, well, we'll come to that in a minute. Let's talk a little bit about Darryl F. Zanuck and his kind of introduction to the world of filmmaking. I mean, he gets a start at Warner's, and he is making movies that still today people are watching and talking about how, you know, kind of great and electric they are. Talk a little bit about his experience there and how he wound up at 20th Century.
Well, he started off as a writer at Warner Brothers, writing Rin Tin Tin movies, and he was electric and he was aggressive. And he understood that a movie should be like a row of dominoes. Once you knock over that first domino, all the dominoes start falling. Mm-hmm. And they're about getting from point A to point Z. And he wanted action. And he expected action. And he thought, and the audience shared that essential baseline desire. And that he started writing other scripts. And he was so prolific and so aggressive that he had to have a couple pseudonyms. Mark Canfield was one. He only used Darryl F. Zanuck for prestige pictures like Noah's Ark, you know, mm-hmm. prestige pictures. And Mark Canfield was the name he used. Gregory Rogers was the name he used. I mean, he was churning out 8-10 scripts a year for Warner Brothers. So he became production head eventually at Warner Brothers in 1928. And that was after sound had roared in. And the early 30s, he basically started hiring people like James Cagney and Edward G. Robinson, and started making those magnificent gangster pictures that were all about the argot of the streets and violence and sex and all those things that a lot of silent movies didn't always deal with directly. He got into a fight with Harry Warner over money, not his. When Roosevelt got elected and took office in early 1933, there was a bank holiday. They declared a bank holiday to stabilize the fiduciary system. And all the movie studios basically cut everybody's salary by 50% over a certain level of income. And they said they would restore full salaries when the bank holiday was over. So when the bank holiday was over, I think it was 3 weeks or something, when the bank holiday was over, Harry Warner wanted to push it forward another couple of weeks so he could save the money and not pay his people. And Zanuck had promised them that everybody would get their full salaries back. And Harry reneged. So, and interestingly, Zanuck didn't like Harry. Most people didn't like Jack Warner because, you know, Jack was kind of a snake. And Harry, you know, came on like an observant Jew who went to Temple and loved his wife and didn't play around. And Jack never went to Temple and always played around, you know. But Darryl liked Jack Warner because what you saw was what you got. And if Jack Warner was going to stab you, he'd probably stab you in the chest as opposed to the back. And he felt Harry had stabbed him in the back by violating the word that Zanuck had given the studio. So Zanuck quit. Because, and also, as he would later acknowledge, Warner Brothers was a family business, and he wasn't in the family. So he started a company called 20th Century Pictures with Joe Schenck, a producer friend of his, who was actually chairman of United Artists at this point. And 20th Century was successful from the get-go. And they did 2 years at 20th Century. And then Fox was kind of a failing operation by 1935. And they merged with Fox because Fox had very good distribution and atrocious pictures, whereas Zanuck was making excellent pictures and United Artists didn't have great distribution. So it was a way of strength meeting strength. They moved on to Fox in the summer of 1935. And 20th Century Fox, Fox originally thought the company would be called Fox-20th Century. And Zanuck said that was a deal breaker. There was no merger if you were going to take second billing. It just wasn't going to happen. So they backed off and it became 20th Century Fox. And they moved on to the lot in 1935. And luckily, Shirley Temple was there and had already started, but hadn't picked up momentum. But Will Rogers was just about to get killed in a plane wreck. And Will Rogers was the biggest male star on the lot. Mm-hmm. Zanuck started off with one star who was gaining speed and another star who had tragically gotten himself killed, which put him in a difficult position. But he coped because Zanuck always coped. And 20th Century Fox was increasingly successful from the day Zanuck walked on the lot.
Yeah, the sense I get from reading your book is that he had kind of shifted away from the Warner's movies that had made him so successful, the gangster pictures, that sort of thing, into the prestige movie, sure, but also just kind of more a slightly more toned down cinema. Is that right?
He had to. He didn't have the personnel at 20th Century Fox that he had at Warner's. Cagney and Robinson and Paul Muni and all that group of talent, Betty Davis too, they were all tied up with long-term contracts. And you don't just pick up Jimmy Cagney and Edward G. Robinson off a street corner. You know, sure. They're one-of-a-kind talents. So Zanuck realized that he couldn't simply replicate what he'd been doing at Warner Brothers because the personnel was different. So he had to reinvent himself, and he had to reinvent the kind of movies that he was making or was going to make, which he did. He absolutely did. What he found when he got in the lot, what Fox had, was terrible story department and bad production, but they had good directors. They had John Ford. They had Henry mm-hmm. King. They had Borzaghi was still hanging around the lot, Frank Borzaghi. He had very good directors, but you don't give Henry King and John Ford or Frank Borzaghi gangster movies where Jimmy Cagney's slapping girls around. That's not who they are. So he had to recast what he did in a more gentle, more bucolic kind of Americana vein. Because that was, he had to play to the strengths of the people he had.
Yeah. I can you talk a little bit about him as not just as a producer, but also as a creative mind? I mean, I one of the things that's very interesting in this, and I think you still see this from time to time in the executive suites in Hollywood, but much less so nowadays, just his ability to go in and pinpoint what's wrong with the story, what's going wrong in the editing booth, you know, which shot should be used, that sort of thing.
He was omnipresent. He went over every script. A first draft script never got produced at 20th Century Fox. It always had to be improved, and it generally was improved, and not just using improved as a synonym for screwing it up. Mm-hmm. He would read a script carefully. His notes are almost always on point and borderline brilliant. And he was specific. You know, he said the problem starts on page 36. And here's why the problem starts on page 36, because things started to slow down. Mm-hmm. You see, he understood something profound about movies in that essentially it's narrative and that a story doesn't have to be brilliant. It doesn't even have to make any sense if it's engaging and if it moves fast enough. The audience will accept it because they want to be diverted. Basically, they wanted to have their minds taken off their troubles. And if the story has flair, and if the actors are good and attractive and kinetic, you're halfway there. And if you keep the story moving, you're all the way there. So he was always hammering pace and sharp dialogue. He wanted, this was a mantra he would repeat over again. And the writers learned that he was almost invariably right. Mm-hmm. That one writer said he had a Geiger counter in his head and it started ticking when things slowed up on the page. Mm-hmm. And he didn't edit the B pictures. He didn't care about B pictures. Those were the province of Saul Wurzel, a subsidiary producer who actually had a different lot. Zanuck ran Pico, the lot on Pico Boulevard. The B pictures were produced at the old Fox lot on Western Avenue in Hollywood. And he didn't mess around with those. As long as they came in on budget or under budget, he didn't care. But the A pictures, he would take over the editing for most of the A pictures. He would look at the rushes of a given picture and he'd say, well, take three is the best one. And the director would say, well, I thought take five was best. And he said, no, take three because of this, this, and this. and his secretary would take down all these notes, and those note cutting notes were always followed. You know? Mm-hmm. And then he would go through costume tests. He would look at the first assembly of the film. Basically, he was the midwife for every A picture 20th Century Fox made.
And again, he was the last of the moguls standing, right? I mean, he was kind of the last big early name to kind of make it through into the 60s and 70s. Right?
Jack Warner sold out Warner Brothers in 1967. Zan, okay, left Fox in 1970, afflicted with early case dementia.
Yeah,
he was, although you wouldn't have known it, he wouldn't have admitted it ever, but he was getting pretty fuzzy at that point. But he was still in the saddle as of 1970.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is, again, reading this book and just thinking about the career that he had and the evolution of Hollywood, there's almost a technological story as much as anything else here, because he lives through sound, the introduction of color, the introduction of CinemaScope. And that in particular, I think, is really fascinating. I mean, you have a lot in this book about the way the lenses had to be crafted and how they were, the process that went into it, the advantages of that over some of the others, even though it wasn't under patent, which is a very strange and unusual thing.
That's the funny thing. It was not copied. It had not been patented in America, which meant that anybody could basically borrow one of the CinemaScope lenses, take it apart, and copy it with impunity, and he couldn't do a thing. But he was he was so desperate, and the business was it was like a parachute had not opened. The business was just plummeting to the ground, and he thought, we have to do something. We have to create. And he didn't think 3D was going to work because it was a gimmick, and pictures were lousy. With one or two exceptions, he thought 3D was pure exploitation. Whereas CinemaScope, you could still make an honest picture. You know, it wasn't about paddle balls bouncing in the audience's face. So he thought this was the way to go, and he spent $10 million of the corporation's money on taking this system, which had been patented in Europe, but the patent had expired, and ramrodding it through for production. It took about a year, a calendar year, from late '52 to late '53 when the robe opened. And by God, it worked. The Robe was a huge hit. How to Marry a Millionaire was a huge hit. All these early CinemaScope pictures were huge hits. At the same time, he's beginning a process of burning out, because at this point, he's been running a movie studio between Warner Brothers and Fox. He's been running a movie studio for 25 years, 70-hour weeks normally, 70, 80-hour weeks. And it's starting to get to him. And he also doesn't like what's happening. He doesn't like the way that actors were assuming more leverage within the Hollywood system.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting point too, Keir, because there's a huge evolution in the business just in terms of who's getting the money.
Yeah.
I mean, like there's, you know, I believe in your book, you mentioned his resentment at the fact that people who have no skin in the game are getting profit points.
Right. See, Zanuck was not money driven particularly. He got $250,000 a year for 10 years. And he never asked for a raise particularly. I mean, he also had a percentage of the corporate profits, but he wasn't money driven. It was about the craft. It was about the job. He wasn't one of these guys who just wanted more and more and more every 6 months. So when actors started getting increasing leverage in the 50s, as the box office fell down and actors started going independent and they found they could make a lot more money getting off the studio payroll and going into independent production or just bartering their services for a little less weekly salary and more of the back end. A-list stars like Burt Lancaster, Clark Gable, that level of stardom, because they did guarantee a certain level of return at the box office. And this drove Zanuck nuts because A, they didn't have any creative input. B, they had no financial input into the picture. They weren't making any investments in the picture. If they made an investment in the picture, that's another issue. But they didn't. So he said, why would you willingly give them 20% of the net profits when they're not contributing 20% of the budget? He thought it was fiscal insanity because they were making more money than he was, basically. And part of it, but also there was a certain amount of creative pride that he took in his business that he felt they didn't share.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
explain that a little bit. I mean, do you think it's just a function of the kind of standard resentment that the actors are just reading the words and that sort of thing, or was it something different?
For 25 years, he'd been telling actors what to do. This is the film you're going to do. We start on June 1st. We'll finish at the end of July. At the end of July, you're starting another picture. He was used to giving orders to actors, and actors in turn were used to taking his orders and doing what they wanted. But a different generation of actors was coming into play. And instead of essential company men and women, well, Betty Davis was never a company woman, but company men like Clark Gable, who basically did what they were told within certain areas, you were getting, you know, a Brando and Burt Lancaster and Montgomery Clift. And they had no interest in being company men or women. They wanted to do serious work, and they felt they had to take control of the apparatus in order to get serious work. So there was a basic disagreement about the role of the actor, but on the part of Zanuck and the new generation of actors.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of the numbers in here are eye-popping, especially when we get to, like, Cleopatra. I always forget just how much money was being thrown around on that production. Let's talk a little bit about Daryl Zanuck's relationship with his son, Richard, which I think is fairly interesting and is the sort of thing that looks like nepotism, you know, at first. It looks like kind of a family business, but really, I mean, Richard Zanuck was a legit executive on his own right. He was not just thrown in there.
He was awesome.
Because he had the right name.
No. He learned the business from the ground up. His father insisted on that. He worked in the editing room. He worked in, you know, production. He did all sorts of things before his father let him produce anything. I mean, Zanuck's first picture is Compulsion, a courtroom drama about the Leopold Loeb murder case with Orson Welles playing Clarence Darrow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a perfectly good picture. It's not, he was a high, any, the problem between Richard and his father was that his father was fine with Richard until Richard started being competition. And then it turns into the Shakespearean, unspoken Shakespearean battle for supremacy and ego. And when, by the time Richard makes produces Jaws, he makes more money off Jaws than his father made in his entire motion picture career. His father had been Campos at that point, it would have driven him nuts. But his father was, you know, already edging towards the gray area. But that was on the way. Daryl could see this kind of thing coming, you know. But Richard was a fine producer, but there was an unhealthy level of competition. As Zanuck got older, he became threatened by Richard and basically tried to first destabilize him within the company. By this time, Richard's running production at Fox and Zanuck is chairman of the board. And it turns into this a quarrel between father and son, handled never directly. I mean, they never really got into it. In the boardroom kind of thing, but it was done through subsidiaries and, you know, other people in the corporation. And ultimately, Daryl fired his son from the company. Zanuck followed him shortly because the company was in bad shape by 1970. And by then, as I said, he had dementia and basically couldn't function very well anymore. But it was actually it would make a good season of something that television show with Brian, the family succession show. What is it? Succession.
Succession. Yeah.
Yeah, right. You could make a really good television series, Ryan Murphy style, out of the battle for supremacy between Daryl and Richard Zanuck.
Yeah. I mean, it is, as you say, it is quasi Shakespearean, the struggle there.
And Richard, because of the tension that grew between them, as Richard got more successful and as his father got less able to cope psychologically and intellectually as his disease progressed. I mean, I interviewed Richard Zanuck a couple times, and Richard Zanuck's attitude towards his father was deep professional respect and absolutely no emotional coloring whatsoever. It was like, as I write in the book, he could have been talking about Sam Goldwyn, you know, oh, what a fine producer, great integrity, blah, 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 blah. But nothing about, and I love my father. No, those sentences never passed. There was no filial feeling, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you know, it's sad. It's sad. It's always sad to hear when something like that.
It's not the only time that happened. It's the same thing. No, Jack Warner fired his son from Warner Brothers. You know, this was not unusual. These guys had to be alone on top of the mountain. They didn't really want to share power because they felt instinctively that power shared is power diminished.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting thing that, again, comes up over and over in the book, is Daryl Zanuck being the guy who is signing off on every production. He's signing off on all the scripts. He's, he's signing off on the final cuts and all that. And it's there was not a lot of delegation.
No.
In his reign.
No, no. And when he left, he finally in 1956, he said, I need to get away. So he quit the job and became an independent producer releasing through Fox. And the studio was absolutely adrift without him because they weren't used to having autonomy spread out amongst the executive producers. Mm-hmm. Simply weren't used to that. So you had a bunch of people who weren't really emotionally or psychologically prepared to take control of the production process because Zanuck had done that by himself. And he suddenly removed himself in his midlife crisis, and the studio got into very bad trouble very quickly.
Yeah. And then he comes back. He comes back for a bit,
after Cleopatra's cost $40 million, and it's a terrible, dreadfully dull picture. Hasn't gotten any adherence in the years since it came out, and the studio's teetering the edge of bankruptcy. They had to sell off most of the back lot to Alcoa to raise money, and Zanuck came back like Errol Flynn, you know, leading the charge of the Light Brigade, and luckily. The first picture out of the shoot for the new Zanuck operation was The Sound of Music, which saved the company short term, but it was also probably the single most expensive picture in the history of Hollywood because every studio suddenly thought, oh, this is a business we understand again. We'll make big, lavish musicals like we used to make 20 years earlier. And so every studio lines up three or four of these big musicals, and every one of them, without exception, drops dead. And suddenly they're right back where they started.
Yeah, including 20th Century Fox with Dr. Doolittle, which is the one of the
Doolittle. There were several of them. And Columbia makes Lost Horizon, and MGM makes Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and it was they all dropped dead because they were all the audience for that picture was simply dying off while they were being shot. All the music snuck in under the wire.
Yeah, yeah. It is interesting. And then all right, so the last, 35 to 40 years of 20th Century Fox is post Zanuck, and it is interesting in its own right. I just wanted to talk briefly about the Alan Ladd era, because that feels like it's a very short period of time, but it's one that both saves 20th Century Fox and also sows the ultimate seeds of its destruction by creating the kind of Star Wars universe and Star Wars effect. Can you just talk a little bit about that period and what it led to?
Alan Ladd Jr. takes over production head duties at Fox in the 70s, mid-70s. And because of his heritage, because he grew up in the business and he understood the business and he came up as an agent and then worked his way up to the status of production head, he did have a very good sense of the overall, and he was in tune with the zeitgeist in a way that most studio heads simply weren't. He was, in a sense, he was a throwback. Of course, the zeitgeist by the 70s moves a lot faster than the zeitgeist in the 1930s because of the overall, adrenaline injection into the media. But he's making, he hired Mel Brooks, does Young Frankenstein. He makes a long string of pictures, Turning Point, that are basically pretty serious adult pictures, and they're aimed at an audience. And on the other end, he also does, he finances this weird picture, Star Wars, a throwback to the 30s serials with three actors no one's heard of. But no one thinks is going to do that well, because who's going to go to see a movie with some guy named Harrison Ford and some girl named Carrie Fisher and some guy named Mark Hamill? What of it, and the thing explodes, and it changes George Lucas's life forever. And a lot of people think it ruined his professional life, because suddenly, instead of being this little Bay Area filmmaker with an interesting knack for searching out hidden crevices in the zeitgeist and making American Graffiti or THX 1138, suddenly he's a mogul. Mm-hmm. Has to keep doing the mogul thing and make and expanding the Star Wars universe. But of course, it's not a problem for Fox because they're distributing the films, but they don't own the films. All they do is distribute the films. But still, it bulks the company up. And Ladd does so well that he ends up leaving Fox to start up his own company, the Ladd Company. And just as he'd been on top of the zeitgeist in the middle and late 70s, he's out. He loses touch with the zeitgeist in the 80s. And the Ladd Company lasts 5 or 6 years and finally goes belly up. So how do you explain that? Well, you can't. It's just sometimes you catch the wave and sometimes the wave catches you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, picked up by Rupert Murdoch when eventually sold to Disney. And there's an almost asymmetry to it. Disney buying 20th Century Fox and not quite merging with it, but certainly absorbing a lot of its properties and labels and stuff. I say it's a symmetry, but it's an end that always I'm sorry, I'm rambling now, but whenever I see the old 20th Century logos and how they are now, it's no longer 20th Century Fox. It's just 20th Century Studios. Yeah. It's no longer Fox Searchlight. It's just Searchlight Pictures. Right. I always get a little bit sad.
Yeah.
I get a little bit sad because it is an ending of a real and fairly glorious and glamorous thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a 100-year-old trademark too. More than 100.
Yeah.
But you know, Rupert Murdoch never really liked the movie business. He's a newspaper guy basically. And he likes the fast turnover that you can get in newspapers, the fast turnover you can get in television. You know, it's alive. It's electric. You change it day to day. You cope with it day to day. And a movie takes a lot of time, And especially as the movie industry has morphed into basically a fan service operation, where studios essentially make one kind of picture, a green screen epic with people in spandex for the Chinese market. And if you do well here, that's fine. But essentially, China can pay for the negative cost. They kind of lost touch with making medium budget films for adults, which was always the bedrock of the movie business. I mean, you made movies for kids, of course, because kids do the movies more often. But if you look at at Zanuck's roster of pictures that he would turn out, 30, 40 pictures a year, 10 or 15 of them were for adults. You know, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Joe Mankiewicz pictures, Letter to Three Wives, or All About Eve, all those pictures, bringing Ernst Lubitsch over to Fox, bringing Preston Sturges over to Fox. Those are high-end talents. And to his credit, he let Lubitsch be Lubitsch. He didn't try to impose his own rhythms on Ernst Lubitsch because he thought Lubitsch was an artist. And he felt the same way about Sturges, but unfortunately Sturges burned out by that time from alcohol and whatever. And the same thing, he let John Ford be John Ford. He didn't suddenly try to tighten up a John Ford picture into 80 minutes. Yeah. John Ford's movies move like people move, like Henry Fonda walked. There's a certain stately progression there. Henry Fonda's not running any place, you know? So Zanuck would lay off people that he thought were on a higher level and let them do what they could do. But for the rest of the directors, they were expected to shoot the film the way he wanted it shot. But he never interfered on the set. He would direct the writing of the script. He would direct the editing of the film. But he never went on the set unless there was a catastrophe, unless the production had stopped and the director and the star were screaming at each other. Then he would be involved. Other than that, the director had to make the film on his own.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. What do you think people should know about either 20th Century Fox or Daryl F. Zanuck or any of this that we didn't touch on here?
Well, nothing. But the reason the movies are the way they are now is because the movies were the way they were then. What we've seen is more of a de-evolution than an evolution. Especially in the last 15, 20 years. Zanuck would be stunned to see Fox bought by Disney, because when Zanuck was alive, Walt Disney was a niche studio, and a small niche studio. It was a boutique operation. Disney would make shorts, animated shorts. They'd make an animated feature every 2 or 3 years, and they make 2 or 3 features a year. live action features. That's it. That was an average. And the reason Disney went into theme parks was because he didn't have the cash flow from the movie business that he needed if he was going to keep the movie business going. Because he wasn't engaged in mass production. So they opened the theme parks and television, and that really gave Disney the wherewithal to keep animation going, which was Disney's passion, his first love. But he also, Zanuck also would have understood that corporations get senile just like people do. And lose their vision of what job one is supposed to be. And so Disney stepped on the gas 30 years ago, and Fox basically slowly slid until they had a very minor share of the market. And so they got swallowed. They got swallowed. He would understand that because he understood business very well. But he'd be very saddened to see that it was his company that got swallowed.
Yeah. Well, on that cheery note, thank you very much for joining me today, Mr. Iman. Really appreciate it. It's a great book. Again, the name of the book, 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck and the Creation of the Modern Film Studio. I'll link to it in the email. You can find it at booksellers everywhere. I picked it up at Barnes & Noble. It's at Amazon. Everywhere you can buy books. I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I'll see you guys then.